Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studio in New York City. We have a lot to share with you today. We're going to start with health and healing, of course, as we do every day. We're going to talk about training your brain to prefer healthy foods, how chocolate improves circulation, how soy, non-GMO soy, organic soy, boosts cardio health in premenopausal people, how the risk of diabetes in children and adolescents is really increased when they're using any form of psychiatric medication, how a chemical in the marijuana oils show promise for treating Alzheimer's, and a lot more. Also today, from our environmental segment, we have the first reports on a saltwater-powered car. Never heard about it? Well, we're going to share with you from Aaron Jackson, Intelligent Living, how this could be the absolute car of the future. Also from our public health segment, for those of you using any form of drug for Alzheimer's, you'd like to believe that that was properly and tested for health standards of safety and efficacy. Well, brand new information that has been nowhere in the American media talks about how major pharmaceutical firms falsified data on Alzheimer's studies, and the government of Japan invested $20 million of its own money to produce the study. I'll tell you who's involved. And then a comment about how do we allow these companies to keep still at the front of the line when they have been serial repeaters of fraudulent research. Because of the upcoming environmental awareness march, I'm going to give some comments about how, though it's very important, and I certainly support anything that raises people's consciousness about the environment, and there'll be booths, there'll be organizers, there won't be any speeches, as far as I understand, and they're not even allowed near the UN, which is a shame, because that's where the UN conference on the environment is going on. But there can be some very positive things come from it, but be aware of how it also has been substantially co-opted. I'm going to mention the actual environmental groups, or other groups, that have gross conflicts of interest, meaning they've taken money from polluters. Then why are they a part of it? Well, because they're smart and they know how to co-opt it. But then it goes deeper than that. I'm going to share a commentary, an investigative report by Corey Morningstar from the Weekend Edition called McKibben's Divestment Tour, brought to you by Wall Street. And this is about Bill McKibben's divestment tour, and it's about the coup d'etat of nature led by the nonprofit industrial complex. You have not heard this insight and information before, and it's really good investigative reporting, so I want to quote him properly on that. It allows you to pull back and look at the larger issues that are never discussed on NPR or the stations that are carrying us right now, because it takes real time to get the facts. We have the facts. We'll share them with you. Let's begin. In the chemicals that are being researched with marijuana, this is not the same as smoking marijuana. This is not what this is. This is finding the chemicals, the particular chemicals that are shown to impact body chemistry. This is the latest from the University of South Florida, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Marijuana compound shows promise for treating Alzheimer's disease in preclinical study. Quote, extremely low levels of the compound in marijuana known as Delta-9 and cannabinoids, or THC, may slow or halt the progression of Alzheimer's disease. And that was a study by neuroscientists at the University of South Florida. And so they're very high on the idea that this could do a lot of good for a lot of people who are suffering. as new studies come in, I'll keep you posted. But we've already shown what it can do for cancers, all cancers, pancreatic cancer, brain cancer in particular, breast cancer, and for heart disease, even AFib and congestive heart failure, it works, the cannabinoids. So more and more science on this. This is from the Aalborg University Hospital in Denmark. This was published in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. It's a study that found that children and adolescents diagnosed with a psychiatric diagnosis had an increased risk of developing diabetes if they were exposed to any of these antipsychotics. And that's important. They studied 48,000 children and adolescents. And quote, the use of antipsychotic drug treatment can be necessary for some of the psychiatric disorders diagnosed in children and adolescents. The study underscores the importance of following the current guidelines that antipsychotics should only be used in children and adolescents when other evidence-based and safer treatment options have been exhausted, end quote. All right, this is something I've done a lot of research on. I've written articles on, I've lectured on, I did a documentary, The Drugging of Our Children, on. Here's my thoughts. That's complete nonsense. Utter rubbish. Why? Because we have found, and you will see in a new documentary, you will see 9 top-ranked psychiatrists. They were selected based upon their reputation. Professors, academics, publishing and peer-reviewed literature, these were the cream de la cream of psychiatrists. Took a completely healthy person, a woman, in and talking about vague symptoms in as little as 2 minutes and 43 seconds to no more than 7 minutes. They were given diagnosis and then given prescriptions. And all for different psychiatric conditions, all over the place. When confronted on the street later and told that it was a completely normal, healthy person, then they said, well, you know, it's all subjective anyhow. There is no valid scientific criteria for determining a person's psychiatric state of mind. Therefore, all of psychiatry is subjective. All of these diagnoses are subjective. And then we included a national panel, worldwide panel actually, of the so-called best experts in the world on developmental disorders. And the person was asked by a physician in the audience, and you'll see this whole thing filmed, that not one single member of that panel of experts, the world's leading experts, could say that there was any objective scientific measurement. No blood chemistry, no MRI, no physical determination that a person had bipolar or schizophrenia or any psychiatric condition. Therefore, it was all subjective. So on the one hand, if everything is purely subjective, and there's now studies showing that a placebo, a sugar pill, is as equal in its help as the most powerful selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor like Zoloft, then why would you give a powerful drug that has serious side effects, including suicidal ideation or homicidal tendencies, if you did nothing else? You give a sugar pill, you're going to come up with the same results. But then it also negates holistic psychiatry. There are people in this country who are board certified in neurology or psychiatry, who believe in first detoxifying the body, especially of heavy metals, of triggering agents such as food coloring agents and preservatives and excitotoxins like MSG or aspartame or caffeine and sugar. And then suddenly you start to see a change in the person's behavior. And then get them away from computers and cell phones that overheat the chromosomes. There are at least 42 studies in the peer-reviewed literature that show that when you use a cell phone for more than 2 minutes a week, you're creating damage to your chromosomes. Now, if you understand a chromosome, at the end of a chromosome is a little cap. Visualize it as at the end of your shoelace is that little plastic cap that allows the shoelace from fraying. And so that's what you put through the holes to lace up your shoes. At the end of your chromosomes, there is a cap. It is called a telomere. The telomere is the aging clock in the body, in different organs, different cells, which means that you are no age. Let me repeat that, and then I'll put it in proper context. Let's say that chronologically you are 40 years of age. Okay, but then we saw that when you were in college, you did a lot of drinking and you did some drugs, and so you're not 40 as far as your heart, your brain, your liver, and your kidney. Let's say that you were a compulsive exerciser. I know such people, and they just can't stop. It's one thing when you're training for an event that you have to put in intense exercise. It's something else when you just have to go out and do this long workout all the time. I knew a guy that ran 10 miles a day, every day, 7 days a week. Today, he can't run a block. Why? Because he prematurely aged the muscles in his body. So that he's not 52, which is his actual chronological age. He's closer to 90 as far as his muscles go. Let's say that you were a smoker 20 years ago, and you smoked for 10 years, and now you're 50. Your lungs are not going to be 50. Your lungs are going to be 90. Let's say, and so were your eyes because of the cigarette smoke. Let's say that you're a caffeine drinker. I used to, every week, I would meet with my publisher every week or so. When I was working on an important article, it was every week. And he was a remarkable human being. I had an enormous amount of respect for him because he was courageous. He would take on major corporations. In fact, we were the first to take on the cancer industry. Robert Houston, my co-author, and I wrote the first major nationally distributed published article on the politics of cancer. And then we followed that with about 13 others on the cancer industry. And he knew that he would lose advertising. He knew that he might get sued, though we had a special research lawyer that did nothing but review all of our articles. Trudy Heller was her name. She would be methodical. Every single thing we wrote had to be completely proven. Then I only did one article with Robert. I went on to do 50 on my own. Every single one was vetted. And if I couldn't prove something, it didn't get in. So there was never a lawsuit. But that set the standard. But the publisher had the courage to do it. So when they had these meetings, he would sit there and drink diet sodas. He might drink 3, 4 during our conversations. Now, he was drinking all day long. That's just when I was meeting with him, generally in the early evening. And I said to him, "You're aware of the chemicals in here, what it's doing to your brain, your lungs, your kidneys." And he said, "Well, I don't feel anything." I said, "You won't today. But there'll be a time when your body's biochemistry will tip, and therefore you won't be able to be healthy any longer." He ended up developing cancer and heart disease. And it was because of constantly infusing his body with agents that were very toxic. And so when you start drinking things that are excitotoxic, when you're using a cell phone all the time, when you're in front of a computer all the time, then you're overexciting the telomeres and you're causing them to rapidly change. And that causes you to die prematurely. Another way I like to look at it is, if you see an hourglass that is your life sands flowing out, and you open up the hole so it's really gushing out, that's what we do when we expose ourselves to excitotoxins. So if you get rid of the excitotoxins, the cell phone constant use, use it on a speaker, keep it at least 6 inches away from your head or body, or get some form of headset that you can listen to it, earplugs. Then you can start to repair the damage. And there's a lot that you can do to repair the damage. One of the best things you can do to repair damage is concentrate of pomegranate, the liquid concentrate, 3 or 4 tablespoons a day, and certain nutrients that are extremely beneficial for the brain and brain repair and neuron repair, L-carnosine at 1,000 milligrams a day, and also acetyl-L-carnitine and choline and acetyl-L-choline and those are the best. But in any case, you've got to take all that into account when it comes to when you're dealing with adolescents and children who've been diagnosed with being hyperactive. Then you also have to look at what kind of environment did they grow up in. We don't appreciate how challenging it is for teachers who may not be very creative to try to hold the attention of students when the life outside of the classroom is so much more stimulating and interesting. And the poor teacher has to try to keep their attention. Now, if you're not a very wise teacher, and if you don't have children yourself, you may not appreciate that the children's energy level comes and goes throughout the day. When they're excited by something, they perk up, and their attention's there, and their energy's there, and it's frequently a hyper-energy. We don't have a recess a lot now, or at all in many places in the United States, where kids can go out and play and let out that energy and then come back in and be focused for a little bit of time. And then they come to school without good food, without good nutrition, and they're bouncing off the walls. So we misdiagnose all this as a brain chemical imbalance, and then we give them psychiatric medications. And then we end up with an epidemic of diabetes. And I'm saying one of the reasons, one, there are many, but one reason we have an epidemic of children having diabetes, but it's adult diabetes, because we're giving them the antipsychotic medication, and they don't need it. They need better parenting, better diet, and taking away the cell phones and the computers, turning them off, and getting them a good night's sleep, and getting them good meals throughout the day, and get rid of the colas and other things that are poisoning their body. That's what's not in that study. Training your brain to prefer healthy foods. This is from Tufts University. I'll quote it. It says, "It may be possible to train the brain to prefer healthy low-calorie foods over unhealthy high-calorie foods, according to research at the Jean Mayer USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging at Tufts University. It was published today in the journal Nutrition and Diabetes. A brain scan study in adult men and women suggested it is possible to reverse the addictive power of unhealthy food while also increasing preference for healthy foods. Quote, we don't start off life loving French fries and hating, for example, whole wheat pasta, said senior and co-sponsoring author Susan Roberts. She said, this conditioning happens over time in response to eating repeatedly what is out there in the toxic food environment, end quote. Now, scientists have suspected that once unhealthy food addiction creates circuits in our body, they may be hard or impossible to reverse, subjecting people who have gained weight to a lifetime of unhealthy food cravings and temptations. To find out whether the brain can be retrained to support healthy food choices, the colleagues studied the reward system in 13 overweight and obese men and women, 8 of whom were participants in a new weight loss program designed by Tufts University. And they had MRIs and brain scans at the beginning in a 6-month period. Quote, the weight loss program is specifically designed to change how people react to different foods. And our study shows those who participated in it had an increased desire for healthier foods along with decreased preference for unhealthy foods, the combined effects of which are probably critical for sustainable weight control. So I think that's terrific. So here's the takeaway message. If we want to change some bad habits, and it's not just food, it can also be some other addictive substances like caffeine, sugar, high-fat diets, smoking. First, we have to be determined. Then it's always good to have a support system. someone that when we feel that we can't do it is there to encourage us, yes, you can, get back up, you can do it. And then it's about understanding the consequences. And what I have found works best is that I can substitute some nutrients like niacin, non-flush niacin. When a person's having a craving, can turn off a craving. Drinking ice water with lemon in it can turn off a craving, a sugar craving, a food craving. I've given it to coke addicts, meth addicts, heroin addicts. It can help curb those cravings. When a person is obsessively hungry, even though they've eaten, give them organic popcorn. And the popcorn doesn't really have calories. It's not bad for them. But it creates satiety. And also using, for people who are depressed or anxious, and that's one of the things that drives their food selections, have them sleep on a magnetic mattress or with a magnetic headrest that pulses into the cerebellum and also impacts the hippocampus part of the brain. And I've seen people literally overcome or improve substantially anxiety and depression taking 15-minute little restorative naps using a magnetic headrest, using geodymium negative gauss magnets. So there are things we can do. If the moment you get a hunger pain, go exercise. Get out there and do a half hour of power walking or biking, and that can also help it. Using melatonin at night also is important. And two other things, chocolate improves circulation. This is and again, we're talking only about organic good chocolate, healthy chocolate. Quote, dark chocolate increases maximal walking distance by 11%. That's good. So if you're having, let's say, 2 ounces of organic chocolate a day, non-dairy, without all the sugars, it increases nitric oxide, and that affects people with peripheral artery disease. That helps you. And why? Because chocolate contains polyphenols that support blood vessel dilation and reduce oxidative stress. They also increase the production of something I've talked about many times in this program, beet juice. You want to do a marathon, you want to do a long bike ride, you want to do a power workout, have yourself 8 ounces of beet juice and you're really creating a lot of nitric oxide. And that is a gas that allows blood vessels to dilate. And that's good for you. Also, dark chocolate reduces platelet adhesion, meaning it makes platelets less sticky. And that in turn enhances circulation and eases the symptoms related to peripheral artery disease. So that's good. And finally, soy boosts cardio health in premenopausal study. This is from Wake Forest School of Medicine. Quote, soy consumption can boost heart health in a study with cynomolgus monkeys, but you have to start early. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause. Quote, this study underscores how important it is for women to get the best cardiovascular shape they can before menopause. Well, a little late for that for about 40 million women, but it still will benefit you after menopause. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health. Now, a couple of things about the environment. This is really important. We thank Aaron Jackson from Intelligent Living for sharing this information. We all know that we want cars to be designed to be more fuel efficient and less polluting. Well, it's here. Not in America yet, but it's going to be. A car which uses electrolyte flow cell power system is now certified for use on European roads. The car is called Quant E Sports Limousine. That's Quant, Q-U-A-N-T, the letter E, dash, Sport Limousine. It made its debut at this year's Geneva Motor Show. Now, not only can this car run on salt water, which it is claimed that the car can peak at power of 920 horsepower. That would be 0 to 62 miles an hour in 2.8 seconds, and it can get to a top speed of 217 miles per hour. Quote, we are delighted as pioneers to be able to present an automobile driven by flow cell technology on public roads, and one which achieves not only fantastic performance values, but also zero emissions. A projected top speed of over 217 miles an hour, acceleration from zero to 102.8 seconds, a torque of four times, and a range of more than 373 miles. Wow. And that was reported in Nunzio La Vecchia. Now, an in-depth inspection of the car, the German TUV Sud in Munich, handed over the official registration plate. Now the company will be able to test the car on public roads in Germany and Europe as the company prepares for series production. And the flow cell system, powered by Quant, it has four electric motors it's developed, and it creates electricity from electrochemical reactions created by two electrolyte solutions. And this electricity is forwarded to supercapacitors where it's stored and distributed. Now, here's how it works. I realize it's a little technical, but it's important we understand that the power density of the nano flow cell at 600 watts per kilogram per liter is greater than any comparable system. It's 500% greater, to be specific. That means you can drive five times further with this system than you would a conventional battery system, including the most state-of-the-art lithium-ion batteries. And the system's also extremely safe to operate and environmentally friendly. And most importantly, since there are almost no moving parts and it produces negligible waste heat, it has an efficiency of more than 80%. Quite simply, there has never been anything like it. Works on salt water and the ions in salt water. That's how it creates the electrical charge. That's good news, and we'll continue to keep you in the loop of when we can expect it in the United States. This is just the latest. Now, I'm going to put first the context and the back end first. 3 years ago, I hired for a year two attorneys to research every Wall Street bank and every pharmaceutical company. And I gave them the following questions. How many lawsuits have they settled with or without acknowledging guilt? For how much money and how many victims were there involved because of the lawsuit? And I was amazed when they finished their research. They brought it up in giant cartons. It was over 350,000 lawsuits in the pharmaceutical industry alone. And in Wall Street, every major firm had thousands of lawsuits. And what I found remarkable was that this is for every kind of cheating and insider trading and price fixing. Just one company, Hoffman LaRoche, one of the largest makers, if not the largest maker, vitamin C in America, was caught cheating by price fixing, and they had to pay a $700 million fine. Okay, fine. What is that? 1 or 2 weeks worth of income for them? So then the question is, if on the one hand, we pride ourselves in the ethics of our business model, then when these people have been found guilty hundreds of thousands of times, including drugs they produce, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry that have been shown to kill people, shouldn't we exclude them from government contracts? Should we not then ban them, ostracize them from having any public debate on issues of public health? Because, for example, the makers of Vioxx, their drug, which was known by them and known by the FDA to be dangerous, causing heart attack and stroke, and Dr. David Graham at the FDA blew the whistle, but no one listened. And it killed more Americans than died in the Vietnam War. So you would think that if you killed almost 60,000 people and caused more than 150,000 heart attacks or stroke. And they never did a follow-up to see how many of those 150,000 heart attacks and stroke subsequently died of another heart attack or stroke. But I would be conservative, I'll bet, to say over 100,000 Americans died because of that. That's bad. And yet not a single negative comment in the mainstream or financial media about the people running the company, the president of the company, or even its future. In fact, when the verdict was read and they paid their settlement, the stock went up. So we have to ask ourselves, what does it say about we as a society and the media when we refuse to hold people morally and ethically and socially accountable for the crimes and misdemeanors against society that have been proven, that have been settled? And yet not a single one of these people went to jail. Not a single person from Wall Street, not a single person from the pharmaceutical company in the cases that were adjudicated. Tells us a lot, I believe. This is the latest. This you have not heard. This is exclusive. This is from Pharmaceutical Online news feature. I will quote verbatim, major pharmaceutical firms and falsified Alzheimer's data. Almost a dozen major pharmaceutical companies were involved in an Alzheimer's drug research project, JADNI, that Japan is now claiming used falsified data. The Japanese government filed a criminal complaint against pharmaceutical heavyweights Novartis. The criminal complaint was unrelated to an Alzheimer's study, but the activity of Japan's health ministry was indicative of their aggressiveness in fighting against drug companies breaking sanctions and regulations. The government invested over $28 million of its own money in order to produce the study, which had a goal of making Alzheimer's disease diagnosis easier and more accurate. Drug companies such as Takeda Pharmaceuticals, Astellas Pharma, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Pfizer were involved in the research project, along with almost 40 different medical centers and organizations. The current head ministry of health in Japan said that the falsification of health data is a very serious issue. Quote, if there really has been data falsification, that would be a grave problem, so we're investigating carefully. Another health minister official said the government was preparing an investigation team to delve further into the results of the study. If the falsification of research for the Alzheimer's project is true, the results could damage reputations for major pharmaceutical companies involved. Already, some of the companies involved in the study are distancing themselves from the project. A spokesman for Pfizer said that the company only helped by financing the research, but did not supply any scientists or researchers to review the data. If the data is found to have been falsified, it would make it difficult for those pharmaceutical companies involved to work with the Japanese government on other projects and might prompt others to investigate state-sponsored studies. End quote. I think that's absolutely wrong. Based upon what I have seen, it doesn't matter what nefarious activities have occurred. They will be forgotten immediately. If the company is fined or reprimanded, it doesn't matter. They have used contaminated vials of blood that was contaminated with persons with AIDS blood. They paid a fine. Their reputation not affected. Companies have done experimental research on children in third world countries, in the Philippines, for example, and in Haiti, giving them vaccines that they would never give to an American child. And when it was uncovered by a French scientist who thought it was unethical what they were doing, nothing happened. So I say right now, there is no major American corporation, not in the pharmaceutical industry, not in the energy cartels, no nuclear plant operators, no one in banking, that's going to lose their reputation because they've lost their ethics, morality, or waged some activity that was illegal. That's the system we have today, and I think it's unfortunate. Back in a moment with an in-depth analysis of our environmental movement, and this goes to the heart of my concerns about We need a new environmental initiative at the grassroots level. And I believe that most, not all, but most of the major environmental organizations whose names we are familiar with have been so compromised or so incompetent when it comes to the environment that they hinder our efforts instead of helping them. And therefore, we have to have a whole new renaissance on environmental issues. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. From our commentary segment today, I'd like to share something from the New Beacon, Ireland, from Richard K. Moore. It really is relevant, and that's because today we talk about George Orwell or Aldous Huxley, and then we look at our reality today, and wow, it is in alignment. I think we have to look at the dystopian predictions. Why? Because in 1984, George Orwell paints a picture of a dark gray world. People are afraid to say anything contrary to the official party line, and surveillance is universal. Even thinking contrary to the party is a crime, and thought crimes may be treated by radical physiological intervention and psychological intervention. Information is closely controlled by the party media, and the historical record is routinely edited so as to conform to the latest party statements. By contrast, in Brave New World, Aldous Huxley paints a colorful, superficially pleasant world. Personal freedom of all kinds is encouraged, even to the point of being a cultural imperative. In the book, a young boy is referred to a therapist because he doesn't want to play sex games with his girl classmate. An adult character is considered unusual because he is drawn towards a monogamous relationship. Drugs and distractions are readily available for mood enhancement. Now, central to Huxley's world is the abolition of the family. It's gone. Sex never results in pregnancy or sexually transmitted disease, and embryos are grown in a modern production process based on selected seed material. As part of the production process, an embryo can be fed or starved at various stages of its development so as to create classes of people, the alphas versus the betas, etc., with differing levels of intelligence and skills. Quotas are set regarding how many people of each class are going to be needed and should therefore be produced. Various kinds of conditioning are then used on infants in order to get them to accept their class, along with its prerogatives and restrictions, as being best for them. Children are raised on a communal basis, with no concept of parents, siblings, or family. From embryo to adulthood, the state has fine-tuned control over the development of the person and their thinking. In the resulting society, people behave as they were programmed to behave and can't imagine things being any different. Now, in Orwell's world, wrong thought, called thought crime, is detected and suppressed. In Huxley's world, wrong thought is unlikely to arise. Orwell's world suppresses the individual. Huxley's world manufactures the individual. Now, in both cases, mind control, control over what people are able to think, is the strategy of the regime. as it means that it can now be able to control society generally. Orwell explores a brute force approach to mind control, while Huxley explores a scientific approach. The novels are useful because they each take one of these basic approaches to mind control and follow its consequences to the end. If you really want to suppress what people think, you need to do A, B, and C. If you really want to program people, you've got to start when they're born and do X, Y, and Z. We're able to see the architecture, the structural patterns of each kind of mind control regime. This can help us recognize precursors, such as the signs of a future coming our way. I believe, and I've shared with this audience many times, that we have echoes of Orwell today. Consider the world of mainstream journalists. In particular, just consider a TV news anchor. There we would see a person who represents the echoes of 1984, where what is said must conform to the party line. It must be a part of official thought, official truth. Any thought crime, such as an anchor commenting off screen or on screen that he doesn't buy the official story about 9/11, or he thinks that Russia was not the primary aggressor in the Ukraine, or that we shouldn't have gone on and killed Gaddafi and destroyed his country, making it into a failed state with a breeding ground for the terrorists and ISIS that we now see in ISIL and in Iraq, and that we shouldn't have gone after Syria because Syria will only become another Libya, and we shouldn't have gone into Iran or Iraq and Afghanistan. Imagine how quickly that person would be punished with the equivalent of a kind of death, expulsion from the world of journalism. Thus is maintained the matrix. The story we're told by U.S. benevolence, the existence of a democracy, the sacredness of market forces, and all the rest. With control of major media in just six hands, the party line can be always maintained, and current or past events can be interpreted within that framework. To do otherwise for a news anchor would be literally unthinkable. Huxley's minister of truth is at work in our world, but it is invisible, hiding away in the boardrooms of media conglomerates and behind the doors of the White House press office. The same kind of thought crime regime is operating in other areas as well, where socially sensitive topics are concerned. The peer review process, the editorial boards, the relevant journals ensure that thought crimes are suppressed when it comes to concerns regarding genetic manipulation, pesticides, fracking, pharmaceuticals, vaccinations, the radiation from Fukushima, closing down our 100 operating nuclear facilities, shifting towards organic growing from GMO growing, the radiation that we get in regular medical exams. Again, none of that is condoned. None of that is allowed. Why? Because the Ministry of Truth is invisible, residing high up in the chain of corporate boardrooms, and will not allow any of that on the air. Now, even though our society doesn't resemble Orwell's dystopia, his mind control methods are operating in very critical places where the population's information is generated. And of course, we do have universal surveillance, courtesy of the National Security Agency and 18 other governmental agencies, omnipresent cameras, cell phone tracking, every single email, every single phone call, every single electronic communication is read, listened to, stored, analyzed. Big Brother is with us, but he stays behind the scenes as he sees all, hears all, knows all, and he decides what stories we are told about the world by the mainstream media. And then we have the echoes of Huxley. Huxley wrote a review of 1984 where he talked about the two different future visions. He suggested we might go through some kind of dark period reminiscent of 1984, but he thinks such a regime would be unstable and transitional. He goes on to say that the scientific approach to mind control based on programming people's belief systems would be the more sensible choice for a modern totalitarian society. The U.S. government's research into scientific mind control, by the way, began at least in the 1960s, and it's been going forward ever since. Remember Operation Mind Control, the CIA, heavy-handed? Yes, it did that. Reminiscent of the novel 1984, this research involved giving people psychotropic drugs, along with post-hypnotic suggestions. Quite a bit could be and has been accomplished with these kinds of methods, along the lines of the Manchurian Candidate. But it didn't provide a general solution. Too much work was required to program people on an individual basis. Research then shifted to cult creation. If people can be herded into cults of various kinds, cult dynamics themselves would serve the programming function. This provides a more wholesale approach to mind control than the individual methods tried earlier. The CIA has never publicly claimed credit for this later research, but the experiments were very successful, including Reverend Jim Jones in the People's Temple and David Koresh in Waco. In this kind of research, the first step is to identify a natural cult leader who has already shown some success in gathering followers. Then the cult is given support by various kinds. Covert agents are sent in to join the cult, not only to observe and report, but also to provide organizational skills. Funds are channeled to the cult, and local police are warned off so that the cult can grow unhampered. In this way, researchers have been able to study how a skilled cult leader operates, how people are drawn into a cult, how loyalty is maintained, and how people can be pushed into extreme beliefs and actions. When everything had been learned that could be learned from a cult, the cult leader and members are then, they're disbanded or killed, and that's how it goes. Now think today. What do we do today that's like this on any level? Well, we have corporate Democrat and corporate Republican parties. It doesn't matter whether you're an African American or you're a female running for office. You're not really running for your gender, and you're not really running for your race. In fact, to the contrary, almost all of the actual laws and all of the actual programs implemented by an African American and by a woman were anti the benefits of the African American population. Poverty did not reduce itself. Employment did not get gained by the African-American population. Income inequality increased. The amount of homelessness, the amount of incarceration, the amount of deportation increased substantially. And then you have no national initiative to cause women to maintain equality in our society. Not at the national level. Individually, yes. But not through national people. Even someone like Elizabeth Warren, when you look at her, she's a really good corporate liberal Democrat. But she sided completely with Israel, along with every member of the Senate, and she has not shown that she cares about we the people. All these are good politicians. Now imagine in the media, you have cult leaders. I believe that the demagogues of the media, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Rachel Maddow, Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levine, these people represent a particular type of person who wants to be told the truth, wants told what to believe, wants to told how to vote, wants to know who the enemy is, and it's always the other. If you're on the right, it's on the left the enemy. If you're on the left, it's the right the enemy. And then look at the banking society. They have so much power that they convinced the American public through their spokespersons, Henry Paulson, who was Secretary of the Treasury, and then head of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, that we need not to give money to small businesses, not to give money to homeowners, not to lower the interest rate on mortgage but rather give it all, 100%, to the major financial companies that caused the problem in the first place. That doesn't make any sense. Why didn't people rebel against that? Why didn't they speak up? because that's what happens when you don't realize how connected you are to the media and the media personalities, the opinion leaders, convincing you that your truth is irrelevant, their truth is all that's important, and you begin to follow them. So I believe that today that we have a mixture of Aldous Huxley, yes, and I also believe that we are also looking at a dystopian society through the eyes of George Orwell's 1984. When you look at how few people are healthy, how many people are obese, how many children are obese, how many people are sick, how many things we do that are unhealthy for the public, how we're exploiting the resources of the environment, how we're privatizing everything, and how many laws we've enacted to make normal behavior illegal, and yet nary a whimper from the people who are impacted. That's why I think we should take a moment sometimes and just look at the world that we live in. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.